70 in 7. A win today, Hockey O'Clock. Original.
Win today, Hockey O'Clock.
In diesem Augenblick wird es jetzt richtig hitzig. Yeah, und die Scheibe kollert über die Linie.
Nee. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Das ist unglaublich, was die hier zelebrieren.
Nice move, another nice move.
It is that time of the week again. It is part 4 of 70 in 7. We're celebrating 70 years of a life dedicated to the great sport of hockey. A life that the player legend, the coaching legend, the overall legend led and is still leading. He is, of course, Greg Holst, and he's, of course, on part 4 as well. Coach, so glad to be talking hockey and your life with you this time around from 1984 to 1994. Interesting meat on the bone part again. First of all, so happy that you're doing this with me again.
Martin, thank you. The first three were pretty exciting, so there are some good stories coming up.
Coach, this will probably happen throughout the next couple of episodes that we're jumping a little bit back and forth because there might be things that come to you a little later after our recording sessions, things that we might just have forgotten. And this time around, you said, you know what? On episode number 4, even though it's from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, we need to talk about something that happened almost 10 years earlier and would have perfectly fit episode number 3. And you just mentioned a name and you said, let's talk about Jacques Cosette. Why?
Well, Jacques Cosette was a great junior player. He played with Pierre Larouche and Desjardins. They had 200 points each apiece. So I'm playing in American Hockey League. I just want to tell you something. It's kind of a funny story. It was my first real fight in the AHL in a league game. So we're playing, and Jacques Cosette was about my size, but he was stocky. So me being a little cocky, the gloves came off, and here we go. And he was tough. He hit me with the left so freaking quick, cut me across the chin. I have the scar to this day. I turned right. He hit me right. I turned left. He hit me again. He hit me 4 or 5 right in the face. My hair was pulled. I'm breathing. I got a black eye. I'm a freaking mess. So anyway, I survived the first part. So, well, you know what? I'm going to go home again. So I take off my jersey, and I go towards the bench, and I'm waving him on. And I'm looking over, and all the guys are going, Holstie, Holstie, you're... It's the wrong bench. Holy shit. I didn't know what freaking bench he was on. So I got the crap beat out of me. And I tell you what, I did not go after Jacques Cosette again. And he never came after me, obviously, because that was a crazy night. The guys got a real kick out of it. And that night, Martin, I drove to a bar after the game with a bunch of guys. I'm driving my car. This is amazing. The cops pull me over. And I go to get out of my car. And they put the high beams on me. Get back in your car. So now there's a few of the players driving by honking the horns. We were going just out of town to a nice little bar. The cop gets close. Boom, I get back in the car. He looks at my face. He goes, what the hell happened to you? Gave him my license. Oh, Greg, Providence Reds. Holy shit. Take it easy. Have a good night. We'll see you later. You know what, Martin, too? I think back at just some of the crazy times, and there was a fight in Rochester. I won't get into it. I fought a guy named Ray Maluta, my size. We went out in the penalty box. Everybody piles in, fights everywhere. We had guys in the dressing room, referee came down with bite marks in their back, with teeth marks and blood. Some nights, it wasn't a whole lot of fun.
Holy crap. I'm on one hand happy that we touched on this. On the other hand, maybe their children listen to this too. So apologies on that front. But then again, they'd need to be able to speak and understand proper English. So maybe that helps to not expose them too much to the kind of brutality of hockey too much. The last time we talked to each other, you said that 1984 is an important year when you look back on it. What made you say that 1984, or what made you decide on that 1984 was indeed so important for your career and your hockey life and your life?
And my life. Well, 1984, what a year. I agreed at 30 years old. We had a team dinner in Innsbruck, and I had agreed I could have kept postponing this. I agreed to go into the Austrian army. So I get into the bar, everybody had a schnapps. Here's the papers. I signed the paper. Now I am officially going at 30 years old to the Austrian army. I had to report July 2nd. So I flew back from Canada to go into the army. And I got a couple army stories. Then, in the same year, I also met Christine, who became my wife and the mother of my two boys. And, of course, the hockey part, what a year it was. And we will talk about that.
Let me just start by mentioning another name that you kind of brought on and said you want to talk about it on the podcast. And I think it happened the summer before the 84-85 season, or maybe two summers before that. But it'll be essential for all the other parts that were still recorded, and just to broaden people's understandings of your situations. You wanted to talk about Red Story. Now, I'd imagine a lot of listeners don't know who Red Story was. Maybe you can share or shed a little light on who Red Story was and what happened that kind of had an impact on your life.
Well, Red Story was a Grey Cup winner in football, a professional lacrosse player, and he was a top referee in the NHL. And he was a great guy, a tall, red-headed guy, loved by everybody. And he would get invited to all the banquets and NHL banquets because he was a great storyteller. But he was refereeing our summer games when we would play in the summer, because we always had a referee. Later, it was Dave Jackson. But Red Story came up to me, and I was still flying and stick counting. When somebody with his pedigree says something to you, it kind of, you don't forget it. Because it was quite a compliment. He said, "Greg, are you going back to Europe?" I said, "Yeah, going back again." He says, "Because if you were interested, I can get you a tryout on any team in the NHL. And I said, "Well, geez, thank you very much, Red. That's quite a compliment." So it's things like that that you don't forget when somebody, the gentleman he was and the hockey guy that he was, says something like that. It's kind of reassuring that, you know, I guess I am a pretty good player.
How enticed were you to tell him, you know what, get me a tryout with the Montreal Canadiens?
Well, that would have been so exciting, because you remember, Martin, when I was Rookie of the Year in the American Hockey League, we had a tie. It was the first tie ever, and I tied with Pierre Mondeau. And Pierre Mondeau won a couple Stanley Cups with Montreal. So you look back, it's not about regrets, but you go, wow, wonder if I would have been with the Montreal organization, what would have happened? Of course, I did play one game there, which was also a dream. So it is what it is. But by the time we're done all of these episodes, there's a couple of things I'm going to say to you.
When we talk about the NHL dream, you played in the National Hockey League, but you deliberately, not deliberately, but you knowingly went over to Austria, probably putting not an end to the National Hockey League dream, but putting it on hold. And then you get to meet Red Story and he tells you, hey, you know what? I can get you a tryout on any team, and you still are thinking that you're still good enough and that you'd have it. And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but at what point did you lay the NHL dream to rest? At what point did you know, well, it's probably not going to happen again that I'm playing in a big show?
Oh, I would say probably a couple of years before that. It was still a compliment at 29 years older. So it was put the rest before that, because, you know, if you're going to go from playing 80 games plus playoffs and how the hockey was, now you're going to Europe playing 40 games. You know, did I play as long as I did? Would I have played in the American Hockey League or possible NHL till 37, 38, 39 years old? The answer is absolutely not. Would I have had the opportunity to get to Europe in my 30s? Probably not. So I guess it became, I had good contracts. It becomes your job. It becomes a business. And 84, 85, as we're going to talk about, was a year I will never forget.
So let's dive right into it. And instead of getting ready for the National Hockey League during summertime, you're getting ready for another chapter of your Austrian adventure. And this time around, it features the Austrian army. And for all the people, and especially the international listeners out there who don't know, there's mandatory half-year service for every adult male in this country for the army. It's normally right around your 18th birthday or the year you turn 18. And back in the day, I think it had to be at the very least 9 months, because when I got called up for the military and I decided to do community service, of course, but back in the day, it would have still been 9 months of public service or service on the army. How was it for you to be joining a bunch of 18-year-olds in July of 1984, with you being 30 years old and obviously not having grown up in Austria?
Well, it was quite... The reason I did it was this. I said, I have my Austrian citizenship. If I do this army, I could have kept postponing it until I was 35, and then I would have been out. But I said, I'm going to do it. They're never going to question me becoming an Austrian. That's the reason I did it. So I get in there July 2nd, and I became the Zimmerkommandant. So in our room, I was the boss. So I remember our first meeting, one of those guys with the two stars comes walking in. All the guys are standing there. And I stuck out my hand to shake his hand, and he started freaking screaming at me. And I said, whoa. And the other guys are looking, and I go, okay. I threw some English at him as if I couldn't speak German. So he was a little bit flustered, but that's how it started. But I can honestly tell you, the first couple of weeks, I stayed in the barracks. And this wasn't much fun because I had a train too, you know, off ice and all that stuff. So I went to the speech and I said to the boss, big boss, I said, is there any chance I could commit at 6 a.m, do all my day stuff, but sleep at home so I can get some sleep and I do my training? And he agreed. But he also said to me, Greg, but we got to make a deal here. When we're lined up, all our 50 or 60 guys in the morning, or 70 guys, whatever it was, I'm going to be jumping on you a little bit aggressive with you. And I said, why? He says, because if I jump on you, everybody's going to stand tall. I said, hey, that's a good deal. So I made sure those guys had hockey tickets and all the stuff once the season started. And that was the start of me going to the Army Konrad Kaserne in Innsbruck.
While all this went on, a lot of things went on with the Innsbruck team too. There was a lot of turnover on the personnel front, and people to this day still look back on this 84-85 season and say this had to be one of the best, if not the best, teams ever put together. We're talking about Brian Stankiewicz. We're talking about Dennis Wolf. We're talking about Alexei Kostilev. We're talking about Rick Bourbonnais. So much high quality talent that was assembled in Innsbruck, with the team slowly but steadily coming together. Did you think, Jesus, this could really be the year?
Well, you always kind of think that. But if you look at our team, how it was built, and Stank was great in nets, I played with Dennis Hull and Kostilyev. That's probably one of the greatest lines ever in the league. And I played with a lot of really good players, with Haring and Bowman, Raffel. And do you realize that the three of us, sometimes they had to break us up on the road because teams would be hacking a Kostilyev or hacking me. So we broke it up a little. But at home, we were fantastic. Do you know we had 257 points, the three of us together? Dennis Hull had 41 goals. Kosti had 31, and I had 44. Our line at home was freaking unstoppable. And we're stanking nets, so we were really top-heavy. So if we're not going real good, I mean, we had Mart Lehner, Tommy Musma, we had Bourbonnais, but if our top line wasn't scoring, chances are we weren't going to win. That's just the way it was. But we had a good club. 110,000 fans that year. Only Rapid in soccer had more fans in Austria than our Innsbruck hockey team.
Hard to imagine if you look at the spectator numbers 30-something years later. But what is interesting and what I was able to dig up is the fact that the newspapers wrote from a Canadian millionaire team. And we were talking about salaries and we were talking about contracts. But in the grand scheme of things, looking back on this season, was it indeed the fact that Innsbruck had maybe one or two more Canadian millionaires than all the other teams?
Well, no, who would they have been? Kostilyev, he wasn't. The Russians had to pay most of their salary back to the Federation. And Hulley was probably, you know, 30 or 40,000. No, Stank made a lot. I made a lot. No, this was not a millionaire team by any regards. But do you know when I was in the Austrian Army? So if I don't come over to the Army July 2nd, you know who I don't meet in August? Is Christine, who became my wife. And I was out at the Casablanca, because Dries was my favorite Moroccan. He's now living in New Zealand, bartender, and we're still in contact. I was at the Casablanca and having a couple of beers with Brian Stankiewicz. And a couple of gals come walking in, really good looking. And I go, okay. So they stood beside us and I said, we had some rums going, whatever you did. I said, help yourselves, whatever. They left, but they came back. And me and Christine kind of had a connection. We met up. We set up our first date. Beautiful young woman. And she became my wife and the mother of my two boys. If I don't come to the Austrian Army July 2nd, I do not meet Christine.
I mean, it's always such a loaded word, but do you believe in kind of fate? You deciding to go to the Army and getting the Army service behind you, and because of that, meeting your wife, and because of that, having your two great boys. Is there anything that you attach to fate, or is it just a word?
Well, is there fate in life? There probably really is, because so many things happen in your life or your career that you have to go, why did that really happen? So is there fate? Yes, I believe there is fate in life. But I have to tell you a quick story on the Army, because when I got there July 2nd, I've given up my summer of golf to do this, right? And they were nice enough, but it was an 8-month gig. But after, once we started the season and the guys came to the games, I set them up. They took pretty good care of me. So I didn't have to go in a lot of times before a game or after. And the soccer guys weren't playing great and they weren't treated quite as good. But we're in mid-July and we had to take our machine gun, our STG-58 machine gun, apart and put it together blindfolded. So this is probably towards the end of July. I'm in there a few weeks. We take it apart blindfolded. We're outside. It is freaking hot. So I take my pieces and I put them all in order so I know where they are. I don't know why we had to do this. So anyway, I start putting it back together. It's freaking 30 degrees outside. I start putting it back together and then I'm searching for the next piece. And I can't find it. And I'm getting freaking flustered because I organized this. I have to get this done. So after about a minute, I'm just going, what the hell? I say, you know what? Something's not right. I took off my headband or my eye protection that I was blinded. And there's a couple of the bosses, the Spies and the other boss, standing there laughing because they took a couple pieces away just to have a little bit of fun with me. All in good humor. We talked about humor. They were having some fun.
When we wrap our heads around the 84-85 season, you had a tremendous start to the year and were successful on an individual basis and on a team basis. But I found a headline where it said unrest in Innsbruck. Crashly wants to step down. And then a couple games later, it said, well, the team approached him and begged him not to step down. What exactly happened had to be around the 7, 8, 9 game mark of the year. What happened during that stretch?
I cannot remember that at all. I was not involved, I don't think, because I would have remembered. I'm not sure what happened. This is kind of the first time I'm hearing this. Did it happen? Maybe, but I cannot remember. Because we had a pretty good team. Mark, not only did I go to the Army, me, Christine, I had one of the best years I've ever had. I had 101 points. So, but Bart did stay on, and we got to the finals, as you know. And I have a story for the finals, which is going to be an exclusive.
There are so many years that we could probably talk in depth about. I singled a couple of them out, and the 84-85 season is one of them where we talk about things that happen in more detail than we'll do with other years that you kept playing in Austria. But long story put short, the building was rocking. It was sold out more often than not. You mentioned the 100,000 plus people that came to the games. Mind you, there were only 39 games played for Innsbruck, and basically half of them being home games. You exceeding the 100-point threshold for the first time in the Austrian League, and spoiler alert, also for the last time. But there were headlines that said Kostelev holds Hull. They're too good for this league. So you had really something going for you. And eventually, just as everybody expected, you get to the finals. And it's Klagenfurt against Innsbruck. And it was the first year where basically playoffs were played in Austria. Started with a best of three in the semis and went on with a best of three in the finals. But when did you, as a team, as an individual, know, ooh, there are going to be playoffs this year? This is going to be different.
Well, I think every year they kept changing the freaking system, so it was very inconsistent. So now it's a best of three, which is pretty tough also. I mean, you can't have a bad night. Lucenau is the number one team, led by Rick Cunningham. And Klangford upset Lucenau. Lucenau was supposed to win. We beat Falkirk in three. And fans were going freaking crazy. So Cartier wins. They upset Rick Cunningham and I think Steve Stockman was there. They had a pretty good freaking team. Cartier wins, and now they're coming to Innsbruck, and we have home ice advantage. So this place was rocking. You want me to keep going what happened? Because this is going to be wild.
I know the score from game one, so I'm very curious what happened.
The score was 6-2. I remember exactly what happened. And they got a couple late goals. Eddie Labor got a couple late goals. But you want me to tell you exactly what happened?
Shoot.
So we have the big line, Huuly, Castilli, of myself. We score the first goal. We're up 1-0. Sulzer's on the ice. After we score, I said something to Sulzer. He speared me right under the heart in the ribs. I go down. You don't want to get speared in the ribs. Dennis Hull jumps in, goes after Sulzer. He gets 2+10 in the box. I am now in with the doctor. I can't freaking breathe. So I say, Doc, I can't breathe. Give me a needle. It was Ecky Steiner, Dr. Steiner. I said, Steiny, give me a needle so I can freeze it. He said, I can't, Greg. It's right under the ribs, under the heart. I said, holy Christ. So our line now is disarray. We're the key. Thanks, Annette, and we're the key. Hooley's in the box for 12 minutes. I am now seriously having trouble breathing. We lose 6-2. Labler got a couple late goals. That is factual. Sulzer, Gilligan was coach. I believe Sulzer never played another shift. Basically did his job. So here's what I'm going to say right now. If I would have just kept my freaking mouth shut and not said something, we could have possibly won that game and maybe the championship. So that is a regret. And when I'll never forget it. Why didn't I just keep my mouth shut and Sulzer would not have speared me? That is 100% true. And almost nobody knows that story. So now you have a line, 257 points. Huuly's out of it, in the box. It broke up our rhythm. We lost the game. Then we went on the road. Okay, but here's something for you. I had a Jeep. A blue Pajero Jeep. I come out. We beat Falkirk in game three. We're heroes. Almost carried out of the rink. We lose game one. My Jeep was full. The windows were full of spit from the fans. My own fans. So you better be thick skin in this business. So we go on the road. Mac was in nets. We had four or five breakaways. We just could not score at Cartier 1. If I only would have kept my mouth shut.
I guess you didn't when you ran into Hans Sulzer a couple of years later. Actually, you met him this just past year during one of the many anniversaries that were kind of celebrated in hockey. Corinthia, did that story, that incident ever come up again?
No. Nobody knows that story, Mark. Maybe one person knows that story. No, this is exclusive. And Sulzer's a good guy. He was a pretty good player, but he was chopping hack. He was a bit of a stick man, but he did his job as you were allowed. And if I don't say a word, I don't get speared. But he's going to hear it now. I don't know if he's going to hear this podcast, but he might. But that is, and I, if I remember correctly, Gilligan did not put him on the ice again. If I remember correctly.
I talked to a longtime Austrian observer of hockey, and he said this had to be your biggest disappointment during your playing days because this team was supposed to be the champ. Is that indeed the case, that this 84-85 year and how it eventually turned out is the biggest disappointment, the biggest kind of regret that you have?
No, we weren't the favorite team. Lustenau was really the best team. They were the top team. I think we were second, maybe second favorite. Absolute disappointment for me, not for winning the championship for myself, but for all the fans that supported us. That 110,000, we had so many dedicated fans coming down from Seletal, busloads of hockey fans and my fan clubs. If I could turn it all back, winning for them in that year would have been absolutely fantastic.
What year marked the beginning of the end of your Innsbruck years? Because it wouldn't take much longer and you'd tie your skates elsewhere, in Salzburg, in Villach, and there were three more years after that in Innsbruck, but Innsbruck and your time there came to a temporary halt at the end of the 80s. Where did that decision kind of grow ripe that you'd wanted to see other places in Austria?
Because Innsbruck didn't want to sign me. Black and white. So Kostyliev, great player, Russian. Viktor Sharlamov, fantastic player. The three of us went from Innsbruck to Salzburg. That was the first year of Red Bull. We had a pretty good team. Senlik was there, Shabisti, Steve Polgar was coach, Bernie Hutz. We had a pretty good team. It just, we didn't have many guys. And we kind of ran out of juice, but we had a great year. We actually, Martin, went bankrupt in November. We never got paid again. I remember getting, because the executor came to the game and took all the money from the fans. And we had really good attendance. And I remember getting a bag of 20s and 50s and 100 shillings every now and then to keep me going. We got paid. We had to finish the year. We got paid from the Austrian government with interest in the next summer. If we would have quit, we wouldn't have got paid. Everybody played. We had enough money to keep us going. And that is factual. So we all went to Red Bull, but after that, I went back to Innsbruck. And if you think my last year in Innsbruck, what a year that was in the Alpine League. I mean, against Mailand, our seventh win, we had 10,000 fans. Frank Way, Scotty McCrory, Felix, Martin Linder, Tommy Buzma, Stankin, Nets, Pertoller. What a season it was. I was 37 years old. I am captain of the team. Berrick, Coach Berrick, wanted me to be captain to lead the team. I didn't really want to do it. He made me captain. He said, Greg, you got to be the captain. I said, okay. I had 21 goals, 51 points. We had a fantastic year. And what happened? I scored my 500th goal that year. Dad happened to be at the game. Hadn't seen me play in 11 years. My number gets retired. Basically, when your number gets retired, that's it. After the season, planning to go back to play, because the guy said, hey, Greg, great year. They didn't even talk to me. But that's just the way it goes. And I remember one night, Carse was always my favorite team. And you know, at 37, sometimes you have it, sometimes you don't. And we had a full house. And I scored three goals at 37 against Kartsey. And, of course, the fans are going freaking bananas. Frank Way comes up and said, Holtze, you got to play like that all the time. I say, Frank, when you're 37, I hope it happens once or twice a year. Great bunch of guys. I scored my 1,000th point. I had Hardy Varrader, the skier, he was involved in the sponsoring group. I got a Tag Heuer watch. I got 1,000 liters of Gooser beer as a gift. And I think the first big party we had, we drank 200 or 300 liters of it. So that was quite a year. But when it ended, they never even talked to me again.
I think we got ahead of ourselves a little bit too far here, because there are still some instances where I want to get your perspective on and seasons where you need to do some explaining. And after almost winning a championship and coming up short against Klagenfurt in the spring of 85, obviously some more disappointments came your way in 85, 86, as regards the Innsbruck team and with the coach turnover that there was. Crashley left the team and Gerhard Kissling was signed. He was ousted a couple of months later because it never kind of seemed to work. The team that had performed so brilliantly the year before just never got on a roll. How do you look back on the early stages of the 85 season?
Let me ask you a question. You got the greatest line that's ever played in Innsbruck. So are you not going to sign Dennis Hull and Kostyliov?
Probably leave them together as long as you want to play together.
100%. So they're bringing Charlebois, great hockey player, Blair McDonald, and Kotov. It just wasn't the same. And the coaching changed, whatever. But how do you break up one of the greatest lines in the history of the freaking league? So I had 51 points. I can't remember exactly what happened, but it just was not the same, even though Vic Blair, BJ McDonald, captain in the NHL, it just, the magic was not there anymore. So, too bad. That's the way it goes. I was shocked that we were not together for 2 or 3 years because it was absolutely, the line was magic. Let's put it that way.
It's interesting that you mentioned, or that you said, the magic was gone. Can you pinpoint that feeling? Was it something that evolved over a longer stretch of time, or maybe were there instances where you said, Jesus, we just don't have it anymore?
Well, I think there was other players that didn't come back too. It just wasn't maybe those two, because Victor Charlebois and Blair, they were good players, but it wasn't the same. And Crashley did a pretty good job coaching, and of course the coaching change didn't really fit with us. So a lot of stuff goes into it. When I say magic, it's just the magic of that line. Because just say our line was an average line. Well, we wouldn't have had 257 points. We wouldn't have made the finals. So the magic was the three of us. Because I never really played with Charlemov. I might have played with BJ and some other guys. I played with Tommy Misma. He was a pretty good hockey player, Martin Linder. But that line was magic, and they let it slip away. So if you're management and you have 110,000 fans, like you said, in 18 or 19 games, would you not keep that line together and bring on another player or two to make us a little bit stronger? When I think about it now, I'm getting a little aggravated, Martin. So maybe we better change the subject here.
You know what? Let's change the subject to something incredibly positive that happened during that 85-86 season. In January of 86, you became a father for the first time. So by the late stages of 1985, you probably already knew what was in store. How was that process for you? Because I think it's always interesting when people who play pro sports then have that drastic change to the life. And who are we kidding? A child coming into one's life is as drastic a change as there is. How was that process for you?
That moment in my life is one of the most special moments I will ever have. Of course, until the next one came too. But Michael was born in the sanatorium in Rum, Tyrol, R-U-M. And I love drinking rum and coke. I mean, is that fate? So I remember the nun, the Schwester, the nun, came up the elevator holding this little bundle. I remember this like yesterday. And the doors open, and I didn't know if it was a boy or a girl. And I said, "What is it?" I go, "What the hell's a boob?" I didn't realize the word boob was a boy. Oh, a boy. Oh, my God. So I had Michael in my arms the first time, and there he was. And all of a sudden, he just started crying, screaming. I go, "Oh, my God. He doesn't like his old man." What a moment in my life. What a special moment for Christine and myself. Michael, the name Michael, came out of nowhere. I think the closest second name was going to be Giacomo. Well, good we didn't call him Giacomo. But I don't know, all of a sudden, it was Michael. And what a special moment in my life.
During this episode, we will hear from Michael. So that's something that I will have already spoiled for a couple of listeners then. But the interesting thing is that this year or the season you were having Michael as your firstborn also marked your last one playing for the national team. Did that go hand in hand? New responsibilities off the ice and also trying to cut down on some on ice time?
Well, I'd have to think so, because as you know, in the 84 Olympics, we weren't allowed to play NHL players. But in 88, the Calgary Olympics, I was allowed. They changed the rules. Bukac did call me. He was the Czech coach. And after the season, having a child, and you know what? I just didn't. What a bonehead move that was. Play the Olympics in Calgary, Canada. If I could turn it back. I mean, we had talked about this, that Richard Grenier took my spot. I think it just was at the end of the year, having kids. I was 35 years old. If I could turn it back, I would have gone. But at the moment, it was the right decision.
I want to double down on having kids and the joy of becoming a father and life advice that comes with it. And this brings me to a story that I want to listen to that reached me from our mutual friend, Markus Pintner. He, who became a father a couple of years ago too, and he takes us back to that year. Obviously, doesn't necessarily fit the stage that we're trying to set right now, but as it's a life lesson and something that you probably developed after the birth of Michael, I thought it fits perfectly for us to listen to this together. And as it's in German for all the English speaking and international listeners, I'll try to sum it up after we've heard from Markus Pintner.
Zu einer weiteren Geschichte von Greg. Ist eher eine Lebensgeschichte und war sehr wertvoll für mich. Holst und ich sind wahrscheinlich sehr ähnlich gestrickt. Es ist 24/7 einfach nur um Eis gegangen. Nichts anderes war wichtig. Das war Priorität Nummer eins. Und vor 2 Jahren haben wir den kleinen Linus bekommen auf unseren Sohn. Da sind wir natürlich sehr stolz. Wo meine Freundin, die jedes schwanger war, hat es natürlich sehr viele Gespräche gegeben mit Freunden, mit Kollegen. Und da sind immer wieder Geschichten rausgekommen, wo die Leute gemeint haben, dass sich alles ändern wird. Nicht immer zum positiven Sinne. Weniger Schlaf und Stress und. Das haben die Leute natürlich überhaupt nicht besser gemeint. Der Holste war aber noch einer der wenigen, der klipp und klar zu mir gesagt hat, Bente, und jetzt ist Stopp. Er hat genug Lebenserfahrung. Da muss ich ihm glauben, da muss ich ihm vertrauen. Jeder einzelne Tag wird ein glücklicher Tag. Jeder einzelne Tag wird ein bisschen besser wie der Tag vorher. Und er hat es wirklich so überzeugend gesagt, dass ich dem zu 100% Vertrauen geschenkt habe. Und ja, bei uns ist genauso gekommen. Also der Linus ist jetzt ein bisschen über 2 Jahre und an jedem Tag, nach jedem Training freut man sich, wenn man heimkommt. Einfach eine extrem schöne Erfahrung, aber auch eine wichtige Erfahrung für mich, dass der Holste für mich da war und dass man da Lebenstipps gegeben hat.
I really liked the story and the way he told it, and it's basically about him just expecting to be a dad, and I think a lot of dads and moms who listen to this have been through this. If you're becoming parents for the very first time, a lot of people will tell you nothing's gonna stay the same, dramatic changes incoming. And you were the one who told them, pints, stop. This is the greatest thing that will ever happen to you, and every day of your life will be joyful and happy because of the little one. And it kind of brings me back to you and that kind of January onwards from 1986 phase where you had just become a parent for the first time. At what point did this feeling settle in? Wait a second, this is great. Now each and every day from here on out is a happy one.
Oh, it was like absolute magic when you think about it. I remember I come home there late a couple nights. Mike was in his little crib there. I'd sleep on the floor right beside his crib. I mean, so it was fascinating. You know what a funny thing about Mike? Mike's a tall, slender, good-looking guy. He was maybe one of the fattest babies you ever saw. And if you remember the Michelin tire commercials, maybe you don't, where the rolls in the arms, well, this we should have called them Michelin. It was absolutely, and I got pictures to prove it. I think Mike is the same weight now as he was when he was young. He just straightened up to be 6'4". Absolutely freaking hilarious. And me and Christine looked at those pictures, and I tell you what, but I will say something about Christine. And I know we didn't make it all the way, which was, of course, devastating, but she took care of the kids fantastically, and I had to play hockey, so she made sure I had my sleep, I had my rest, I slept in the other room when I had a game. She did a fantastic job. She was a fantastic cook. She really took care of the kids when I was still playing hockey and gave me the space I needed and the sleep I needed. So she did a fantastic job when the kids were very young.
But this probably goes out to all aspiring parents and parents who just had the very first one. Enjoy the time. Because I think that's a cliche that everybody gets told too. It flies by and time goes so fast. And after a year or two, you really look back on it and go to yourself and tell yourself, yeah, time did fly by. So enjoy it as much as you can, if you can relate to these experiences a little bit.
Well, just, Martin, let me make a quick comment to Pintsy, because you and me and Pints are pretty good friends. I coached him. I coached him. We also coached together. And people actually did say, Greg, does it really get that bad, like when the kids one or two? I said, are you kidding me? Once the kid starts walking and talking, it's freaking hilarious. There's so many fun. You're the father of two young kids. You see how exciting it is? So, no. My view on it maybe is different than other people or some people, but Paichi is a fantastic dad, and he's so excited about this. And he's also coaching kids, so which he never thought he would do, and he loves it. So Marcus Pintner's life has changed for the better.
Let's turn our attention to the year 86. In January, your first born son came into this world. In April, May, you play for the Austrian national team for the last time. After that, it's your marriage. And then you're heading into an interesting 86-87 season. In terms of general busyness and things that happen, was 86 indeed one of the busiest years of your life?
Well, of course, when your first child's born, it's mega exciting. And then we did get married. Mom and dad and friends all came over. We had a fantastic wedding. And maybe the last year of the national team. But just getting married, and Michael came to the wedding. So you see how things changed in life. Mike was at our wedding. So mom and dad were there. Everybody came over. It was really fantastic. And it was a busy year, but you know what? It's no busier than so many people. So you just, you keep rolling, you keep playing, you do your private stuff. And then we went back to Canada in the summer and had a great time. So it was quite a year.
When you go back to Innsbruck for the 86-87 season, a lot of new faces again on the Innsbruck team, and none more interesting than Sergei Kapustin, seven-time world champion, Russian hockey player, and he was signed from Spartak Moscow. But I found an interesting newspaper article where a lot of people weren't sure if the right Kapustin had been sent to Innsbruck because he had a brother named Igor. And I could read from the article, but it wouldn't make too much sense. It was just confusion if Innsbruck had gotten the right Kapustin. Did you know about all that, or did you just have to rely on what club management was doing anyways?
I had no idea. Viktor Sharlamov was already there. What a career he had. What a player. Sergei Kapustin came. What a player. One of the greatest all time. In the top 10 in Russia. Couldn't really speak English. Couldn't really speak German. But he was quite a player. And I have a story when we went, because the three of us went to Salzburg the next year. And Viktor Sharlamov and Kapustin always played together. But Kapustin, I remember in Innsbruck one time, it was his birthday. And he phoned me, and he's talking freaking Russian. And I, g'day, you, yeah, snop, snaps. I have no idea what he was talking. But he phoned me and talked to me. And we had no communication skills, but we figured it out. But you know what's funny? They love drinking vodka. Russians love vodka. And they would bring good vodka and caviar over. So me and Stank, a couple of times, the girls would all go downtown. We're going to meet them downtown. And Viktor and Sergei would invite me and Stank over to their apartment. And Greg, come in. And we'd have a pile of really good caviar, and he'd pour us a nice tall shot of freaking vodka. I look at Stank, I go, holy shit, Stank. So we have a couple of these, and then we say, hey, Sergei, do you have any beer? Like, we're Canadian guys. We drink beer. Oh, beer. We'd have a couple of beers. They loved their vodka. Then we'd go downtown, have some fun. But, you know, these Russian guys were great guys. The problem with Kapustin was everybody was after him to take him out, world star. He just never got a break. But when we went to Salzburg, and I remember this, Steve Polgar broke up the line. And I played with Kapustin for a couple games. Martin, I'm going to tell you, I could read off him, and he could see the game, and he could pass. If I would have played with Sergei the whole year, I'd have scored 70, 80 goals. That's how smart he was, and I knew how to get open. But the Russians, most of the time, played together. What a hockey player. And you know what I learned from those guys when I was in my mid-30s? How to skate better. I was always quick laterally, but I watched them skate when we do our laps. They had this long stride. You know, the power. I learned to become a better skater in my mid-30s watching Sharlamov and Kapustin. Not so much Castilia before, because he was more like me, really lateral. But these guys could fly around the rink. I became a better skater in my mid-30s watching these superstar players. And, you know, unfortunately, Sergei died at 45. Quite a sad story.
Let's just remain quickly with the 86-87 year, because it ended in another disappointment. You played a great year for the most part, got into the master round, and then it's playoffs, and it's best of five semifinals. You play against Vienna, and you get ousted 1-3 in the best of five series. Another year where at the very end, it just says, there is always next year. How disappointing was it that this championship that every hockey player, every pro hockey player at one point, of course, wants to win, had still eluded you to this point?
Well, it's always disappointing, you know, but you have to remember other teams are pretty good too. So, but you know what's funny? Even in the American League, we lost in the finals. I was close so many times. Sometimes with the system from the year before, oh, we would have won. So no excuses. It happens. But you know what's funny? When I played baseball, we won the championship in Montreal. Kenny McCarthy, my good buddy, was my catcher. I played shortstop and I was pitcher. And when I pitched, Kenny was my catcher. And we had all these signs and we had crazy times. We had a really good baseball team. I wanted baseball. So what are the chances of winning a baseball and not in hockey? But it is what it is. You can't turn it back. Like I told you, 84-85, one of my biggest disappointments for the fans. What happened in that year, if I could turn it back, I would have just zipped it up and not said a word.
We'll leave all those disappointments right here. We're going to take a quick break here on 70 in 7 part 4, and then we're back for more about your playing days from 1984 to 1994. Back after this.
Win today, hockey, football. Do you enjoy listening to Win Today, Hockey O'Clock? If that is the case, then please rate the podcast. A 5-star rating or a review over at the podcast dealer of your choice would go a long way in helping to spread the good word of hockey. Win Today, Hockey O'Clock, the hockey podcast with real and open-ended hockey conversations.
Win Today, Hockey O'Clock.
Part 4 of 70 in 7, the series about the great hockey life of Greg Holst, with Greg Holst. And Coach, we've been talking about some tumultuous Innsbruck years so far. And the second time that you put on another jersey in Austria than the Innsbruck one happened in the year 87-88. You joined Salzburg. Why?
Well, Steve Polgar was coach. Innsbruck did not want to sign me, Charlemagne, and Kapustin. So the three of us went to Salzburg. And we had a pretty good team. We had Doug Hicks, Peter Tsanilek, Bernie Hutz, Rudman was in nets. The home guys were great, IB. And we had a small team, though. It was the first year of Red Bull. We actually started filling the rink. We beat Cartier one night. I remember they were the big team and the fans went absolutely crazy. That was the year Gerhard Berger came in our dressing room, came in on the ice with us in warm up. That was way back. That was the first year of Red Bull. And we just didn't have enough players, but we had a really fantastic year and we were all together for that one year and then it was over. And then off I went to the next team.
Back when we prepared this series, you said in the mid-80s, there were some interesting contract negotiations. I know of a couple that took place in Innsbruck, but how were contract negotiations with teams other than Innsbruck?
Well, they were pretty simple. There was When I went to Salzburg, didn't make as much money as I did in Innsbruck. It was just, here's the budget. Here's what you can make. Here's your bonuses. Fine. And you agree to it. But in Innsbruck, I did my own negotiating. And when I became a coach later on, which we will talk about eventually, I did some of my own contracts and I made some really interesting moves, what we will talk about. But in Innsbruck, there was one time in Innsbruck, they wanted to sign me. So I meet two of the management at Hotel Europa, across from the train station. I remember where it was. We're sitting in there and we're talking. I said, well, guys, I'm going to want a 2-year. Let's take a look at some numbers. So whatever the numbers were, 35, 36, 1,000 first year, US dollars. The second year, 35, 40, whatever it was. I said, okay, guys, apartment, car, flights, which was standard. How about in my first year, I make this. In my second year, I make this. They looked at it. And they responded really quickly. And I said, okay, a little bit too fast. I said, okay, I had to start thinking here. Guys, give me a little time. I'm going to go, give me half an hour. I'm going to go call my agent and talk about this deal that's on the table. So the hall of the inn, they had this little bar where I used to go for a beer. I went over and had a couple little beers by myself, gave it 30 minutes. Went back to the table. I said, okay, guys, I talked to my agent and I said, okay, in the first year, I would like 3,000 or 4,000 more here, whatever the number was, significant. In the second year, I would like this, 3, 4, 5 more. Boom. The rest of the stuff stays the same. And they said, ooh, they had to think about this. So they pondered back and forth. Finally, they said, well, okay. And your agent, boy, he must be a pretty smart guy. I said, yeah, he's not stupid. I signed those two little beers I had. I probably made $7,000 to $10,000 US dollars more. Contract negotiations.
Without talking to an agent. That's the importance here.
Without. And I think they said, well, who's your agent? I said, my dad's my agent. Oh, he must be pretty smart. Yeah, dad doesn't even know about this.
Now you're in Salzburg. Now you're playing for your third Austrian team and you're doing it at an advanced age for hockey back in the day, 34, or it was your age 34 season. At what point did it maybe first hit you that you can't play hockey until you're 60?
Until I was what? 60?
60. 50, 40. At what point did you understand there is a natural end to one's playing career?
Well, it wasn't in Salzburg at 35, because I felt great. And we had a really good team. We had a whole lot of fun. Just we did go bankrupt and we didn't get paid till the summer, other than a few dollars to keep us going. But at 35, no, I didn't look too far ahead thinking, oh, I got 2 more, 3 more, 5 more years. We'll get to when I finally did retire, why I retired. And it wasn't because I couldn't play anymore. Other circumstances caused me to stop. But when I was at Salzburg, no, I felt great. We had a good team. Steve Polgar was coach. A lot of fun. Great bunch of home guys. Great fans. And even though we went bankrupt, we still played right to the end. The guys gave it all they had the whole season. And that was the first year of Red Bull.
The first of many, at very least, as it turned out later after they re-entered sponsoring hockey in the mid-2000s. From Innsbruck to Salzburg, I mean, from a sportive aspect, kind of made sense. You trying out new adventures. But how was it to have your child? Did the family stay back home in Innsbruck, or did they move with you to Salzburg? Did you go back and forth?
Oh, no. Christine and Michael, they were with me in Salzburg, 100%. And they love Salzburg. Christine, Taylor's just a young fella. But I also scored my 400th goal in Salzburg. And we had a picture in the front page, I think, with Hicks and a couple of the guys and the wives, Christine, Michael. So that was a fun time and met some great people in Salzburg and really good memories, really good.
And you, of course, set attendance records during the year, but it just wouldn't end up in a championship. Quite the opposite, as you were a sixth place team after the year and you wouldn't even get into the playoffs as Klagenfurt won another championship that year. And that hunger for a championship, was that maybe the motor in kind of leading you to Villach? Or phrased differently, what was the motivation to join VSV in Villach after your year in Salzburg?
Well, Bart Crashley was coaching in Villach now. And he contacted me. I'm sure he contacted me and said, would you be interested in coming to Villach? And I said, yeah. And what a year that was. A year nobody expected. And we had some really good players. Servinus, Kenny Strong. I mean, Rick Wilson, NHL player. Herbie Holmberg at Raffel. Peter Schabisti, Neon Lindert, Petrick, Ressi, Secchi, Sievitz. What a team we had. And Thomas, it was the Nets. So I did sign the contract. And I remember my fixum wasn't that big, but I had good bonuses for first, second, third place as the year went on. Do you know that year, Thomas had played fantastic in Nets. Do you know that we never lost a home game the whole year? There was ties until the last game. And a few things happened before the last game, which we'll talk about. What a year. A lot of games we shouldn't have won, but we just found a way to win. You know, maybe. And I had a really good year. Kenny Strong was a great player. He led the team in scoring, and I had 38 goals and 79 points, I think, that year. So I was still going strong, and I felt pretty good. And I loved playing at Villach. The fans were fantastic. And what a season. And I'd say Thomas and Nets was probably his best year he ever had. But great bunch of guys, great fans. How it all ended was too bad. Couple circumstances that we'll talk about.
I want to talk about some other things first and mostly sporty things. Because there was this huge rivalry between Villach and Innsbruck ongoing, two powerhouses at that point. And during that year, or before that year, Villach hadn't lost to Innsbruck for two full years. So a lot of things and a lot of excitement surrounding every Innsbruck-Villach clash. And you were quoted in one of the Austrian newspapers by saying, well, my exit from Innsbruck wasn't the best or the nicest. And this gives me extra motivation to really show it to them. Why was it, or what happened after your last Innsbruck year, and how long did this really kind of boil inside you, that feeling of not being wanted around and really, really trying to stick it to them?
Well, it did boil inside me because I know the business. I know the people that were involved. Hey, they love you, they hate you. One person says, oh, no, let's get rid of him. Hey, it's part of the business. I don't think I was boiling inside. You just get over it. I had a great time in Salzburg. I had a great time in Villach. Nothing to do with any players. Certain people in management, even to this day, there's some jealousy. There's some stuff that happened that I'm probably not going to throw out there. But Innsbruck is Innsbruck, and they got a good gig going now. So let's just leave it at that.
I want to fast forward to the end of the year. And obviously, smart hockey fans know what happened. You joining Villach and, of course, Innsbruck becoming champion that year. The championship, again, eluded you. This time around, you had to see former friends, former players hoist a trophy as Innsbruck players, you again coming up empty-handed. And it brings me to a story that your good friend Ozzy Praxmager, whom we've heard from in part three, delivered. And it surrounds, of course, that year in Innsbruck and how he looks back on helping them win a championship while you came up empty-handed. We'll listen in and I'll translate afterwards for all international listeners.
Ja, dann war 1988, also 87, 88 ist der Greg dann nach, ich glaube, Graz gefahren gewesen und dann in Villach im Unten gewesen. Und da war der Bart Gräschli Trainer. Und ich bin damals dann vom Kilias, eben vom Co-Trainer, hatte mir haben es mehr auf Cheftrainer hingemacht und so weiter und so fort. Und das Kuriose an der Geschichte ist, also der Greg und ich, wir sind beide nicht Meister geworden im Eishockey als Spieler, sondern eben ich 1988 mit in Villach unten, wo mein Freund Greg Holst in der gegnerischen Mannschaft war und wo mein der Trainer, was mir sehr geholfen hat, Bart Gräschli, auch Trainer von einer anderen Mannschaft war, nämlich vom VSV Villach. Das war ein bisschen kurios und ich war dann sehr happy, wie der Greg dann vor ein paar Jahren den Meistertitel als Trainer mit Villach gemacht hat, weil er hat sich nichts mehr verdient, als wir diese Auszeichnung eben als Staatsmeister zu sein als Trainer, und da bin ich sehr froh und dankbar für ihn.
Take us back to that year and to the decisive moments of the championship. How was that for you?
Okay, there's two games to go in the year, right? It's just kind of a round robin. We played in Falkirk. I remember if we win in Falkirk, two games to go, we're Meister before the last game. And Falkirk had a pretty good team too. But what happened was a few games earlier, we had Kenny Strong, myself, and George Savinas, centerman. And George Savinas broke his leg. He was a really good player. And I remember distinctively going to Bart Crashly. I said, Bart, we need a freaking player. Kenny's got a sore back, and I'm myself, and I'm not the youngest, but we might not survive this. He said, no, we're going to be fine. I remember that conversation. We weren't fine. Kenny had a great game in Falkirk. I think he got three goals. I didn't have a great game. Okay, so we boom. Now it's one game. Innsbruck played in Klagenfurt before the last game. And Klagenfurt played without several players. Maybe they were hurt. Maybe they weren't. I don't know. But if Cartier wins that game, we're Meister. But don't forget, Innsbruck had a really good freaking team. Stank and Ness. I mean, they had Lavallee, Rocker. They had a Werner, Carrick, Lynn, they had a lot of really good hockey players. This is not an automatic. And we had a hole at center. I really believe that. Anyway, we get into game. This is a one-game take-all. Places, but you know what's unbelievable? I'm going to the game, and Michael's in the apartment and Christine. And I'm walking out. And I said, Mike, if we win tonight, we're going to be Meister. And he said, Daddy, no Meister. I said, what? Nein Meister. Michael said that he knew something. Anyway, we get into the game and we're down 4-1. I come over to blue line, take a shot, make it 4-2. We're hanging on. In this particular game, even though we had an unbelievable year where we should have lost at home many times, but we didn't, Innsbruck was just the better team in this game. And as disappointing as it was, I was really happy for one guy. And that's O.C. Praxmager, a real good friend of mine. He won the championship. It's the way it is. But you know what's funny in sport, Martin? You're an NFL guy. You're a sport guy. You lose in the finals, not everybody calls you a loser. So sometimes sports can be tough. I don't consider myself a loser at all. It's just sometimes sports, and that's the way it goes. I'm happy I won in baseball.
But I mean, from the crooked omen that your son tells you, no championship, no Meister, to eventually losing on home ice and being the runner-up for the championship, and you scoring that goal that made it 2-4 in minute 52, to add injury to insult, one of the goal scorers to eventually make it 6-2 for Innsbruck was, of course, Villach icon Gerald Rauchenwald. So that's something. But how was it seeing the championship again? The championship that was kind of dangling in front of your nose again being taken away. And this time going to Innsbruck, a program, a club that you had shaped to a certain degree.
Well, it was definitely a mega disappointment for all the Villach players, for the Villach fans, that Innsbruck won. It was kind of a very strange feeling. And like I said, it did question me myself a little bit. But you have to get over it. And it was very, very disappointing. But a year later, where was I? Back in Innsbruck. But no doubt, it was a fantastic year. And I was going to sign again. I feel like I had a great year, got along with the guys, it was fantastic. And it was basically all set. And Crashley decided to go with Eddie Labeler, and he said, goodbye.
That simple.
That simple. I don't think it was a goodbye. I was probably still in Innsbruck. And no, they signed Labeler. And no, the business is you got to be ready for stuff. You know, once you're done, you're done. People don't really care. And you know what's funny? When we lost in 84-85 in the finals, it was in the paper that the coach had said, well, Greg didn't have a good game. Well, you know, I didn't broadcast it, but I couldn't freaking breathe, which is irrelevant. And the reason the fans were pissed off at me and spit all over my thing, because it all came out that I was out the night before the game in 5 different cities and 15 different bars wearing my own jersey. So, yeah. I wasn't out, but can you imagine me being in 10 places, wearing my own jersey, having a party? So perception, it didn't happen. Disappointment in ice hockey, yes. So as OC did mention, when I finally did win as a coach in Villach, what a moment that was.
This, of course, will be something that we are going to talk about down the road here on 70-7. But for the moment, please bear with me in terms of part number 4, the years from 84 to 94 that we're going to talk about today. And I want to focus or turn our attention a little more to off the ice stuff. And I mean, it's well known that you do like your golf, that you do enjoy walking the beaches. Did you do like warm weather? I mean, who doesn't? But let's talk about those things separately. Why is it that hockey players seem to have a natural attraction to golf? And how was it that you fell in love with the game?
Well, I would say I golf a little bit when I was young. But I think it's also, well, golf's a fun sport. And I think it also fits in your schedule because you have the summers off. You know, you do your training and stuff, but you have a lot of time to golf. But you're together with 3 of your buddies or 8 of your buddies, and you go golfing and have a couple of beers and you talk sports. It's so much fun, and it's a great pastime. And I tell you what, it's frustrating. It's not a simple sport, but I just think it's another sport. We have time off in the summer. And it's just a great game to play. And it really is relaxing going golfing, even if it can be frustrating sometimes. And, you know, Martin, one of the reasons too I played a little longer, and because I could play, we had a home on Sanibel Island in Florida. And we would go there for 4 months off season. Michael actually went half a year to school there. Taylor went to preschool there. Mom and Dad had a place down there. So we would go there for about 5 or 6 years for 4 months. I trained on the island in Florida, Sanibel. What a fantastic place. What a great time we had. I would train in the morning, do my weights, 4 to 5 every day. I would run 5 miles, go hard as I could, come back, pick up the family. We went to happy hour, had some oysters, some shrimp, a couple beers. That's how I trained. And playing a little bit longer kept me motivated to keep being able to do this. A luxury time on Sanibel Island in Florida with Christine, Michael Taylor, and my parents. Because they had another home. So that was a great, but you know, for mom and dad, it was a good time to see the kids grow up a bit because living in Europe, they were in Canada. They didn't see them too much.
And it's interesting that you're, and it's good that you're mentioning Taylor, because the year 89, April of 89, got you your second son, Taylor. And we talked extensively about you becoming a dad for the first time, but how did becoming a dad of two change things for you?
Well, double luxury. Absolutely fantastic. Are you kidding? Taylor's born. Wow. So Michael's there, Michael's three, Taylor's born, Christine gets through it all fantastically. Two boys. Healthy, number one. Christine was healthy, the boys were healthy. Another one of the finest moments in my life, like not even a question asked. And you know something about Michael and Taylor? We got pictures when we went to Florida, went to Canada, went everywhere. They're brothers, but they got along so good their whole life, even though there was a 3-year age difference. Other than a couple little arguments, they got along so good to this day. So talk about two proud parents. I know parents sometimes play a large role in how kids act, but the kids were fantastic. They got along great. Wow. It's two of the finest moments in my life. Not a question asked.
I will talk about more of some fine moments that happened in your life and hopefully keep happening to you. But a funny story that reached me, and that it's got to do with your off-season activities, of course, comes again from Ossi Praxmager. You talked about the championship that he won with Innsbruck on Villach Ice, and how much it hurt him to see that you again were eluded by a championship. But this time around, Ossi focuses on something that happened during vacation. I suggest we just listen in, and then I'll do some translation and we'll talk about it.
Ja, Martin, ja. Probieren wir weiter noch ein paar kleine nette Storys, was auch im privaten Bereich reinkriegen. 1988 hat der Greg Mieder und mich, da sind meine Kinder 3 Jahre gewesen und 5 Jahre. Und da hat er mich eingeladen nach Florida, da hat er ja gelebt, in Sunnybell drüben, hat ein Haus gehabt, ein wunderschönes, nach Florida zu kommen. Und da bin ich mit meiner Frau und mit meiner damaligen Frau und meinen Kindern nach Florida gefahren, haben wir im Haus beim Greg gewohnt ein paar Tage, wir haben uns getroffen, das hat alles wunderbar hingehaut, wunderschöne Zeit gehabt mit ihm. Und eines Tages sagen wir gehen jetzt, am nächsten Tag haben wir gebucht gehabt, wir gehen Tiefsee fischen. Ein Freund von uns, der war Kapitän von so einem großen Boot, und dann haben wir gesagt, ja, wir nehmen das mittlere Boot und wir fahren ganz früh raus. Okay, wir sind um 6:30 in der Früh aufgestanden, runtergefahren zum Hafen, und am Hafen unten war nichts. Ich habe außen der Hafenmeister gesagt, keine Chance, außen sind 4-5 Meter hohe Wellen, wir können auf keinen Fall rausfahren, es ist einfach zu gefährlich. So, da sind wir 3 Tage gestanden, wir 3 Männer, also damals. Okay, dann haben wir gesagt, dann sind wir zu McDonald's gegangen, ein Frühstück nehmen, ein kleines. Und nachher sind wir wieder zurückgefahren Richtung Sunnybell, auf zur Insel um mich. Und dann sagt der Greg, hey, stopp, fahren wir da rechts rein, da ist eine riesengroße Golfanlage, die wollte er sich schon lange mal anschauen. Und da hat man gesehen, Open House und so weiter. Und dann sind wir da reingegangen und da sind wir da hinten umgefahren, wo noch die Baustellen waren von den letzten Häusern und so. Und haben uns einmal die Gegend da angeschaut und sind da durchgefahren. Und dann fahren wir, kommt gleich nach einer Viertelstunde, 20 Minuten, kommt ein Manager daher und fragt uns, ja, was wir wollen, und hin und her und bla bla bla. Und dann sagen wir, ja, es wäre toll, gefällt uns die Anlage, sehr schön, und niemand hat mich gerechnet, dass wir irgendwas wollen da. Und sind wir halt im Gespräch gekommen, und auf einmal hat sich das so ergeben, dass wir da drüben womöglich eine Wohnung kaufen, nicht? Also, gleich gar nicht, und ich eine. Und ich war damals 28-jähriger Bursch mit zwei Kindern und noch kein großes Einkommen. Ich habe mir gerade davor, zwei Jahre davor, einen nagelneuen Audi gekauft und Greg hat schon ein bisschen Geld gehabt und so weiter. Jedenfalls, lange Rede, kurzer Sinn, bin ich nach Hause gefahren und habe zu meiner Frau gesagt, ich glaube, wir kaufen uns da eine Wohnung. Dann sagt sie, bist du verrückt, wie soll das gehen und hin und her. Und Mots jetzt gehabt und Mots Theater und so weiter. Lange Rede, kurzer Sinn, wir haben uns wirklich da eine Wohnung gekauft. Hab dann über 10 Jahre die Wohnung am Golfplatz gehabt. Der Greg war zwar der neben mir mit seiner Wohnung. Seine Eltern waren immer wieder bei mir in der Wohnung eingemietet, weil das natürlich habe ich meinen Freund was zugehen können, dass ich günstig eingelassen habe in die Wohnung. Und die waren immer im Winter tot und wir waren im Sommer allem tot und haben dort in Florida in einem Urlaub, wo wir nach Fischen gehen wollten, haben wir eine Wohnung gekauft. Dann haben wir gesagt, ja, wir sind wirklich zwei, wie man so schön sagt, fucking crazy guys.
He finished by saying, we were fucking crazy guys, because he told a story about a joint Florida vacation where you two both ended up buying an apartment. I guess it's what you do when you're in Florida. How do you look back on this story and then all the happy times spent in Florida?
Oh, some of the greatest times of my life. My parents absolutely loved Sanibel. They were there for 15 or 20 years. They built the first house. I bought the first house. They built another one. And that's how I ended up down there. But this was Kelly Green's, just off of Sanibel. Kelly Green's golf course became beautiful. Yeah, we both, that's how she kind of got down there. We both bought condos at Kelly Green's and had them for quite a while. And that was our connection. We had a fantastic time in Florida. And eventually when mom and dad didn't go back to Sanibel. They didn't have a home anymore. Mosey had an apartment just off the island. And he really took care of my family, mom and dad. They used the apartment, or I used it, really cheaply. He made us fantastic deals. Mosey was a very generous person. And, you know, when you look back at all the great times we had, what is the most important things from sports and hockey? Is the people you meet, the friendships you build over the years. I have hockey friends in Kelowna, Montreal. You know, my buddies off track a bit, like my good friends here, Dave Boyd, good friend of Montreal. He played in Italy a few years. Kenny McCarthy, one of my best buddies. He played, won a championship in Norway. George Towers played in Sweden, played pro, still lives in Oslo. Dave Henderson, I played junior with him. We're still in contact. Lives in Amiens, outside of Paris. And he coached the French national team for 15 years. You would know the name, Dave Henderson. All my buddies played hockey somewhere in the world. We're still connected. Only Norm, a good friend, played up to junior. But Kelowna, Gilly, all the guys, we all played hockey together. Sats, George, hockey brings you all together. And when you get all these guys together, there's just a mutual respect about playing the game. You know, the good times, the bad times, the pressure, the injuries. So one of the greatest gifts hockey can give you is the friendships you build over the years. And me and Osi, we had a fantastic time. We still have a fantastic time to this day.
How important were those off-season getaways, and how much or how many years did it help you have in hockey, like getting proper rest and getting away from the sport, and then return during the late stages of summer and early fall for another year? How much or how many years did this help get you or tack on in hockey?
Well, there's two sides to that story, because as long as I'm playing and making decent money, I can afford to go to Sanibel and spend 3-4 months and train, you know, from mid-March to 3-4 months, fantastic weather. We did buy a boat. We went to all the little islands. We lived a luxury life. It wasn't really a normal life, but it was fantastic. It kept me in shape. Like I said, I did my 90 minutes of workouts in the morning, my weights and stuff, and I ran in the afternoons as hard as I could. I would run 5 miles as fast as I could, starting at 4 o'clock. And I remember my motivation. I do things like this. If I don't run these 5 miles in a certain amount of time, my kids are going to have nothing to eat. That's the kind of stuff I put in my mind to push myself. So I would do that. And like I said, we had a fantastic time. Because the longer I'm going to play, the more we can go down off season and enjoy Florida, Sanibel Island. Motivation on both sides.
Ozzy Praxmara, your good friend from Innsbruck, who happened to coach the team that you then rejoined, spent times with you in Florida. He alluded to you two buying an apartment. At what point did that friendship become a business pro hockey relationship again? At what point were you certain, okay, let's close the Villach chapter and move back to Innsbruck?
Well, there was never a question of business between us. I would have loved to gone back to Villach, and we were very close on the deal. But Bart Crossley made the call, and that's just the way it is. But I went back to Innsbruck the next year and had a really good year. Well, I think I spent 2 or 3 more years after that in Innsbruck. You probably have the stats. 2 more years?
3 more years.
And my life, 3 more years, yeah. So I had good years going back to Innsbruck, and I could have really kept on going there. But after my final year, where I had a really good year, and the team had a good year, and the fan support was fantastic, it was over. Not a word spoken. Not a contract offer. Scotty McCrory, Frank Way, the guy said, Holtzy, why aren't you coming back? I said, don't ask me. It was over. Right or wrong, it was over. And I was captain of that team. And towards the end of the year, Barrick, the coach, who wanted me to be captain so bad, he said, Greg, you got to help lead this team. I want your cap. He must have got wind, because I remember my dad was over. He must have got wind that they were not going to re-sign me. And I remember distinctly his attitude towards me as we got close to the end of the year changed. Right or wrong, that was the way it was. So I kind of knew the writing, something wasn't right. The writing was on the wall. But was there ever, hey, Greg, thanks for your great years, your 500th goal. We retired. Once that number was retired, that's basically goodbye.
We're talking about the 89-90, the 1991, and the 91-92 season. And those seasons turn up to shape a big deal of Austrian hockey lore, because around that time also the Alpenliga was born, you scoring goal number 500, which in itself is mind-blowing. And there's this great story to goal number 500 to it that you, I think, started alluding to at the beginning of this conversation. But please, for all the listeners who might have skipped a part or two of this conversation, what's it with goal number 500, and why was it so special for a certain someone in the stands?
Well, my mom and dad were at the game, and dad had not seen me play in 11 years. And if I remember correctly, the first game when he was there to watch me, I got in a fight early in the game, I got thrown out. But he was there one game later, and we're playing against Varese. Jim Corsi's in nets. They had Kim Geller, my buddy. They had a really good team. And I scored a goal, 499. And my 500th goal was against Jim Corsi. It was a 4-on-3. I was on the point on the power play. I walked in, took a slapper, scored. Everybody come on the ice. Dad had not seen me play in 11 years. What are the chances of him seeing my 500th goal? And wow, what a night. So you know what's funny? All the guys came on the ice. Congratulations, whatever. We got a 2-minute penalty for too many men on the ice. The refs gave us a two. It kind of gives me the cringe here. We got a penalty. So after that goal, we had to kill a penalty because the referee said, no, you can't all go on the ice. Only in Austrian hockey. Sorry.
But leading up to, this is incredible, by the way. But yeah, this is Austria in a nutshell, probably. It's a no fun country. Leading up to this record setting goal, were you aware where you stood in the record books that you just needed two more to get 500? And after it had happened, did you celebrate any different, or is it just a blur because the bench is emptied and everybody was on the ice?
Well, after the game, but you know what happened? Rudy Koenig had 499. And I had, Rudy Koenig was a great player, great goal scorer in Klagenfurt. And I had 498. And he had a game before me, which he did not score. So when I got to two, I was the first to get to 500. But after that game, mom, dad, my buddies, my friends, close friends, we went to see Dries, my bartender, my Moroccan bartender, at the Casablanca. We had a little party. So when I walked in, I said, Dries, all the bottles of rum, put them aside because we're going to drink some rum and Coke tonight. So we drank all the rum in that bar. We had a party. Mom and dad were there for my 500th goal. It was a fun night, and I did mention after when I got my 1,000th point in that year, I got 1,000 liters of beer from Gusser. And Hardy Weidrader, they gave me a Tag Heuer watch. And that year at Christmas, I got a gift from Willie, my brother-in-law. And it was this big square box. And I go, oh, Willie, this is nice. I picked it up and it was really heavy. And I said, Willie, what are you giving me? This is really interesting. I opened the box. You'll understand. It was 10 kilos of salt to go with my 1,000 liters of beer, because I like salt in my beer, as you know.
What happened to the 1,000 liter of beers? How fast were they emptied?
Well, we had a party. Frank Way, Scotty McCrow, we had a big party at my place, all the Austrian guys at my place in Battens. And we drank a couple hundred pretty freaking quick. We had a few kegs going. Yeah, over the year, my father-in-law, he went in anytime, picked up a case, or I pick up a case. Yeah, it probably went a couple years. We just pop into Gusser, grab a couple cases. Really nice gift and good old memories of hockey. And that year, we had a great bunch of guys. I think I told you before, Martin, the Alpha League was fantastic. Now, the night we beat Milan, that top team, we had 10,000 people at the game. And we won the game, our seventh in a row. We had three standing ovations. We had to go back on the ice. This is a league game. So you see how Innsbruck, how exciting hockey can be in Innsbruck. When you're rolling, boy, did they ever support us?
Just to put it in historic perspective and let people know where we are on our timeline here on 70 in 7 part 4, the 500th goal that you scored took place and happened on October 24th, 1991. And it happened during your next to last year as an Innsbruck player. And you already told us a little bit about how it all came to an end. After your time in Innsbruck had come to an end, how certain were you that this could be it for your playing career? Because after that, there's only one more year of pro hockey, and it's on paper an interesting one because you joined Graz. How did all that come about?
Oh, I basically thought it was over because the Graz deal came about not that quickly. And I thought it was over. But I was kind of hanging on to, do I want it? And the contract wasn't great. I think it was only 300,000 shillings or 400. But I said, okay, it gives me another year. Christine, two kids, we got to move to Graz. Not simple. Two young kids. Graz had a great hockey team. It didn't go the way I expected. A lot of things happened in this year, as we will talk about. Was I hanging on for one more extra year? Probably. Could I, should I still be playing at Innsbruck from the year I had before and the guys wanted me, the players? Yes, but it wasn't my decision. And that's the way it goes. So I ended up in Graz, ended up signing, kind of a late signing, and we'll give this one more shot.
What was that Graz team? Because legend has it that so many weird things happened around that team, especially with the influx of money. They were called the Elephants. And it's one of the more interesting chapters of Austrian hockey. And I have to really admit, I haven't been able to fully wrap my head around everything that went on then. But I read somewhere that there were real elephants at the rink at one point and incredible stuff that was happening around that team. Did that already go on when you got there, or was that or did they save that for a later stage of the Graz elephant hockey organization?
Well, put it this way. I never saw any elephants on the ice, but there was an elephant in the room and there was a lot of shit going on in that room. And we had a great team. And we had Bertillon, Daniel Bertillon. He became a friend of mine. I mean, he came right out of the NHL as a goalie. He was one of the quickest goalies I've ever seen. Don Nachbar, NHL, big, tough. Paul Lawless. Gruel. Dorn was there. Dorn was a really good hockey player. Peter Senelik. Rob Doyle. What a freaking team we had. I mean, this team was loaded. And stuff did happen in the room. It was kind of... there was an elephant in the room, and something happened that I think basically became the end of my career. The writing was on the wall when something happened in Graz, and you're probably going to ask me what it was.
Just wanted to say, would you care to elaborate?
Yeah. Peter Tsenlik was captain. I had no desire to be captain. We had a coach, Barta, who ended up coaching after in, and a good coach in his right, but he's not the right coach for 10 Canadian guys that are tough as freaking nails, and an NHL goalie who wants lots of shots, and he's got a temper, and he's a crazy little bugger, but a great guy. So, Peter Tsenlik's captain, and I have no desire to be captain. But the players wanted to have a vote for captaincy for whatever reasons. So I get voted in captain. I don't want to be captain. I say, guys, I just want to freaking do my job. I'm 38 years old. Anyway, Greg, just do it, whatever. So I become captain. I think that was the beginning of the end. Because we went along. Barta ended up, when I got the captaincy, some of the guys would show up hungover and stuff, and Barta would call me over. And he said, get out, you're captain. What's wrong with Lawless? What's wrong with those guys? Well, they were hungover. They looked a mess. I said, it's not my job to babysit these guys. My job is to play good hockey. I didn't even want to be captain. Anyway, Barta didn't last. Then they brought in another coach that was not going to work. But I have to tell you a story about Dorn. We go on the road. I am captain now. This is exclusive. Because I had mentioned Doran was a very good hockey player, but he had stuck me and hacked me most of my career, and we never could fight. We are playing in Allegheny. We're down a couple goals after the first period. We're in the dressing room. I remember this like it's yesterday. And Doran says something to me. Hey, captain, you're captain now. Say something, said in a German. And right there, I stood up in the middle of the dressing room. And I said, okay, Doran, I'm going to fucking say something. Let's go, you and me, right now, middle of the fucking dressing room. This is our chance to go. I waited. He said, sit down or I'll give you a slap. I stood there, waiting, gloves off, ready to fucking go. I would have gone freaking nuts. It did not come to blows. That is factual. I was ready to go. That was my chance. Anyway, what happened was Walter Chedelec, great hockey guy, great career. He ended up taking over the team. And he wanted me to go to the second division. I think I had 4 goals, 9 assists in 20 games, something like that. He wanted me to go to the second team to play on the second team. And I said, no, I'm not going there. So I was on a conversation with somebody and it was overheard that, Graz is not really the place for me. I should be in Innsbruck. That's kind of where my heart is, but it's not. That conversation was heard by somebody in management. And that was it. I said, it's time to go. They said, Greg, let's make a break. It was time to go. So that was the end of my career. And I said, Christine, let's go to Florida. Went to Florida for 6 months, went to Sanibel. Kids went to school, spent 6 months down in Sanibel. My hockey career was over. It didn't end the way I wanted it to end, but I'm going to tell you, that was a hell of a hockey team. And if we would have had the right coach, a good, tough Canadian coach, we would have been unbeatable. And that was the end of my hockey career in the first league.
You know what? Still pay money to see the fights that, well, hockey fans never really got. Doran against Holst. Can we make this happen?
No. That's all passe. I see Doran now. We have conversations. Hey, Connie, how you? It's all okay. It is what it is. But I remember that, boy. I remember that moment. And I was ready. I don't care how old I was. I was ready to go.
And in all honesty, I mean, you didn't do it, but you wouldn't be, because there might be a word that's in your head, but you wouldn't be the first person on planet Earth that calls him or called him a rat. Actually, I know 3 of them. So there's that. And that's what is probably to be said about the player he was. You come into an end or to grips with your hockey career and the first league hockey career. How was it calling it a career? Was it relief? Disappointment in the way it ended? What was the dominating feeling?
Oh, tough question, but the way it turned out, Graz just didn't seem to be the place for me. Like I said, when you're older, if you have the right coach, coaching for the right reasons with the team that you have, that would have kept me excited and motivated to play. There's not a question about it. I couldn't fix the team and be captain. I just wanted to go and play. We had a lot of really good guys on the team. In a way, it was relief. In a way, it was disappointment. But all in all, I got out of 18 years of not being too beat up, back, shoulders, some injuries and stuff. But I got out of it relatively healthy, touch wood. And now we're going 6 months to Florida, which was a great way to end my hockey career, or that part of the playing, although I did play after in a couple of situations, which we will talk about eventually. I would say relief, disappointment, all kind of wrapped up in one.
You see, I thought long and hard when to play this message that I got from your son, Mike. But at the very end, I thought this is the perfect spot to round out this conversation. And this decade where a lot happened. Your prime, the end of your career, you becoming a father. And then this reached me from your son, Michael. And I suggest we'll listen in together. It's, of course, in English, so international and English-speaking listeners will be able to understand that for a change. And then we'll quickly chat about it and let this one simmer a little bit. Here's Michael Holst.
Hey, Martin. Thanks for having me on the show. I'm sure you've been getting a lot of good stories about Greg's life so far, but I just want to touch on what it was like growing up with him as a father. We always had a lot of fun growing up, my brother Taylor, myself, and Dad. We'd play a lot of sports, hockey, baseball, basketball, football, even hit balls at the driving range from as far back as I can remember. It's funny thinking back. No matter what game we played, he always seemed to be the biggest kid and have the most fun. I actually just saw a photo of us when we were living in Canada one winter. He flooded half the driveway for us to play hockey on. It was about 3 meters by 5 meters, but it was probably smaller than that because we were pretty small at the time. But I just remember having so much fun. We would play 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 1-against-1, or even just shoot pucks at the empty net. Our neighbors would join us, and we all would just have such a great time, especially when it started snowing. Other years, we would get up in the morning, have a pancake breakfast, and then go find a frozen lake somewhere. Sometimes we had our shovels with us to shovel a rink on the pond, or a lot of time, our rink was already shoveled by others, so we would just start playing. Sometimes we'd play with our friends, and sometimes there'd just be a bunch of people playing, and he always seemed to find a way to get everybody together to play a big scrimmage. But we did have to earn our fun time. We always did our homework and did our chores the best we could. We had a lot of family time together. And there's a lot of little lessons that I remember from my childhood to this day that hopefully one day I can pass on to my children. And I'll definitely try my hardest to be half the father that he was and still is.
Anything to add here?
Well, if you can see my face, I got a tear in my eye. Pretty emotional stuff. And back to those times, boy. We had a basketball net in the freaking driveway. That little rink. You know what's funny, that little rink, too? When we first got there, the kids had to go to school. I'm like 40 years old. I'm stick-handling around the rink, shooting, putting my hands up. The freaking neighbors thought I was like some kind of nut. We remember that distinctly. We throw baseballs and football. We play basketball, ball hockey. So much fun. And yeah, they did their homework and their chores, but their mom, Christine, was also really influential on doing homework with them and making sure they had good food. So we had a really, really fun time for so many years, and we still do. Very nice words from Mike. Put a tear in my eye. And you know, Martin, before you talked about fate, is there such a thing as fate? If I would have signed and stayed in New York, if I would have gone to Germany and not ended up in Innsbruck, would I have Mike and Taylor right now? Funny how it all works. The two greatest gifts in my life. Because I ended up playing in Innsbruck.
Coach, I can't really wish for a better way to close out the fourth decade of your being. Four down, three to go. And the next one will already come out a week from today. Thank you so much for doing this. Always a pleasure talking hockey with you. Looking forward to the next three episodes of 17-7.
Martin, thank you very much. Wow, what a ride. What a way to finish. Thank you.
Win today, hockey. Oh God.
Kurz durchatmen bei diesem Wahnsinn. Und das ging rasend schnell. Der Traum vom Finale ist erfüllt. Mittendrin statt nur dabei.
Mit Fans, stimmungsvoll und hoffnungsfroh.
Nice move, another nice move. Oh, it's gone.